Democrats see an opening on gun control with help from President Trump.
Take the firearms first and then go to court.
And has the president set a course for a trade war?
The Canadians seem to be hinting at retaliation already.
The Justice Department taking aim at big name drug companies, while the president says give drug dealers the death penalty.
These people can kill 2,000, 3,000 people. And nothing happens to him.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. With Rachel Sutherland and John Decker, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. Is this time different after Columbine, Sandy Hook? Just about after every school shooting, there has been urgent talk about doing something to make our schools safer. What about this time, after the massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida? A lot of Democrats and even some Republicans who have advocated for tougher gun laws think this time could be different with the help of an unlikely ally, President Trump. Just listen to some of what President Trump said about the NRA, gun restraining orders, and even a debate over an assault weapons ban on Wednesday.
I like taking the guns early, like in this crazy man's case that just took place in Florida. He had a lot of firearms. They saw everything. To go to court would have taken a long time. So you could do exactly what you're saying, but take the guns first. Go through due process second.
In that meeting with 17 lawmakers from the House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats, plus the vice president, President Trump also surprised attendees, especially Republicans, by signaling at least a willingness to consider a partial weapons ban proposed by California Democrat Dianne Feinstein.
You know, the problem, Dianne, is that these aren't where you walk into a store and buy. These are where somebody hands you a gun and you hand them
some
money.
Oh, no, you go into a store and you can buy an AR-15.
You can.
You can buy a Tech-9. I mean, you can buy all these weapons.
Well, this is what you're going
light
to have
triggers,
to discuss.
Many
Joe,
bullets.
Yeah. Joe and Pat, you're going to have to discuss that. You'll sit down with Dianne and everybody else.
President Trump also renewed his call to raise the purchase age of some firearms from 18 to 21, despite NRA opposition to that idea. And in fact, in a conversation with Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey, the president suggested the reason some of these ideas haven't already been added to legislation is fear of the NRA. It's a charge Toomey told reporters afterwards he did not take personally.
If there's a Republican who's demonstrated he's not afraid of the NRA, that would be me. The NRA, as you may recall, opposed Manchin-Toomey very aggressively.
Manchin-Toomey is legislation that would expand background checks to additional gun sales after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. The measure failed to advance in the Senate. But there's now new hope for it from supporters after the president's seeming embrace of the bill. Of course, even after that meeting, there's doubt, especially from Democrats, about where the president will ultimately land. Here's what Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy told reporters afterwards.
I'm not sure if that was a reality TV show or whether that was an indication of what the White House is going to be pushing up here in Congress over the next few days.
Murphy says the only way meaningful gun legislation passes this time is a forceful commitment from President Trump to convince Republicans to go along with it. Now, some of those concerns from Democrats have started to take hold. President Trump may be walking back a bit from some of his talk earlier in the week. He met Thursday night with the NRA's top executive. In a tweet, the president called the meeting good and great. Chris Cox, the executive director of the NRA's lobbying arm, tweeted about that meeting as well, saying the POTUS and VPOTUS support the Second Amendment, support strong due process, and don't want gun control. The bottom line is there will be a lot of different proposals in Congress. The question is what can win bipartisan consensus, and is this done through a comprehensive bill like President Trump has suggested, or a series of separate bills? So back to our opening question, is this time different? After each mass shooting, these debates have flared up in Congress and cable news and on social media, each side blaming the other for trying to grab guns or being complicit in the murder of children. In such a heated environment, what legislation could survive? Let's talk about that with my colleague here on Capitol Hill, senior producer Chad Pergram. You and I watched this session, 17 lawmakers meeting with President Trump, Republicans, Democrats, House, Senate, bicameral, bipartisan. And President Trump made clear he wants Congress to go big on a response to these school shootings, used the word comprehensive, kept suggesting that they merge a lot of these different proposals. What does Congress do with this guidance now from President Trump?
This has long been the criticism of President Trump from Capitol Hill, is that there is a lack of clarity as to what it is he wants, regardless of the topic. What does he want on border security? What does he want on immigration? What does he want on DACA? They go away for a week or two or a day or two or an hour or two, and it changes. What we learn from this session is something that the president does want. He clearly wants to change the name of the background check bill. It's called the Fix NICS bill, NICS being N-I-C-S, the abbreviation for the background check system, and they want to fill the plugs, you know, sort of plug the holes in that.
But that's because he wants this Fix NICS, which is pretty narrow. This is an idea where there just wasn't enough information sharing in the aftermath of the Sutherland Springs church shooting. The shooter had been discharged from the military. There had been some convictions that he should not have been allowed to have a gun. So this is a pretty narrow fix. What the president talked about was merging that language with the Manchin-Toomey background check bill, which is
handguns, right?
Which is more expansive, but did not get 60 votes the last time it was up for a vote.
Right, and that came in the spring of 2013, about 3 or 4 months after the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary. And, you know, that's always the problem in the Senate. We certainly saw it on the immigration and DACA debate a couple of weeks ago, that you always need 60 votes. There were several proposals in 2013 on firearms that got more than 50 votes, but you got to get 60. And so that kind of dooms everything to fail. The problem that we saw in this meeting with the president is that he says he doesn't want a bunch of bills. He wants one kind of comprehensive, was the term he used, unified bill, and was turning to people like Dianne Feinstein, Democratic senator from California, who knows something about firearms. She was the mayor of San Francisco, became the mayor because another former city council member, city supervisor, shot and killed the sitting mayor George Moscone and Harvey Milk, another supervisor. She actually found the bodies and talks about how she actually, this is a little bit gruesome, but it tells you what she knows about firearms, put her finger into a hole on Moscone and Milk to try to see if she could find a pulse, and then was later armed by the city police and taught how to shoot because they thought there might be threats to city councilors. So again, she knows something about firearms, but she was talking about, this ban on assault weapons. And at one point, the president was like, well, can we add that in? The problem with any piece of legislation is sometimes you put things into a bill and you make it sweeter for people. These are called sweeteners, and you get another group of members to come across who wouldn't have voted for it, otherwise. The same problem you have, but the same token, is sometimes you put those things in and they become poison pills. And so to get that balance, that legislative balance right, is very challenging.
And to that point, Fix NICS, which is what we have talked about, this John Cornyn bill, has actually passed the United States House of Representatives. But what was the sweetener? Well, I think Fix NICS was the sweetener in that bill, because the base bill was concealed carry reciprocity, where a concealed carry permit in one state is valid in another state. President Trump was very direct when he spoke with the whip of the Republican House and said, you got to take that out.
Right. Steve Scalise, tried to, kind of educate him on this a little bit, that's a problem. I've spoken with members of the House Freedom Caucus who would be apoplectic if they tried to do that. Let's say they take the bill that the House passed, the reciprocity across state lines, and also then the Fix NICS, the background check. They strip out the reciprocity in the Senate because that won't work in the Senate. They send it back to the House of Representatives. Well, you may have infuriated the Freedom Caucus, but the vote attrition that you would have there is probably picked up by the Democrats. You know, that's not always the case on pieces of legislation, and that's the problem that Republicans often have in the House of Representatives. But again, to get much beyond that, you could see a scenario, Jared, where Democrats say, wait a minute, we want to do more. We're not going to stop at just background checks. We need to see something. And this is the tension that Republicans are having, especially in the Senate. I talked to a couple of senators this week who said after their luncheon on Tuesday that there's one group of folks who say we just have to do something, or we're afraid that we as Republicans are going to be blamed for not doing anything. So they just want to do something. And there's another group that's afraid to touch anything, because if they open it up beyond background checks, then you're getting into banning weapons or age limits or a number of other things. And that's something that conservatives just don't want to get into, especially as we approach Republican primaries.
The last question I would have is somebody who's watched all of these debates over the last several years, Chad, is the president's timeline seems pretty swift. As we know, Congress is not always as swift as presidents would like Congress to be. Is this an issue that continues? Does it have the momentum for a long debate, are we looking at a pretty small window of opportunity here for Congress to make a move?
Now, maybe what's happening, as big as each of these incidents are, you know, you start to see the tectonic political plates move just a little bit. So maybe we're not to San Andreas fault level yet on this, but the plates, you know, Columbine, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, Aurora, you know, the tectonic plates move ever so slightly. And maybe this is all it does. It might seem like these are major seminal events, but you're just shifting the plates. And maybe at some point there is that you know, the big one, as they would put it in seismic terms.
We'll see if this is that moment. Chad, thanks so much.
Anytime.
If you had not heard the name Hope Hicks much before this week, you've probably heard about her since, at least if you've listened to our newscast or watched cable news segments about the departing White House communications director. Her resignation is only a bit of some of the palace intrigue happening inside the West Wing. Just this week, President Trump again harshly criticized his attorney general. Doing the job of keeping up with all of it for us is our White House correspondent, John Decker. John, we should start with this announcement that Hope Hicks is resigning her post as communications director. Now, Hope Hicks is not the most visible member of this administration, but boy, has she played an important role in the president's day-to-day operations.
She has indeed. So her title, up until the time that she resigns, is White House Communications Director, but she is so much more than that. She is described by some people as being the Trump whisperer, in the sense that it is Hope Hicks that has had the closest relationship with first candidate Trump and now President Trump. She is the person to whom President Trump can run all ideas by. She is the person that President Trump can confide things in. And she has been, I think, without a doubt, one of, if not the most loyal and trusted advisors to the president during his time in office.
And she's been with the president in some capacity for a long time. Her role in the Trump organization predates any run for the White House. And then after the run for the White House, for a long time, you and I, John, were covering then candidate Trump. She was like a one woman press shop.
She was indeed the first hire by President Trump, then candidate Trump, as he embarked on his quest to win the White House. The reason being is because he just had immense trust in her. She's only 29 years old, but as some describe her, wise beyond her years. Her background is in public relations, first hired by Ivanka Trump to do PR for her company. And Ivanka was so impressed with the work that she did for her, she told her father, we ought to have Hope work for the Trump Organization. And taking that advice, Donald J. Trump did hire her for the Trump Organization. And when he began his quest for the White House, the first staffer he brought on board was Hope Hicks.
There was a lot of talk about the timing of this announced resignation. She announced it, what, one day after spending an entire day in front of the House Intelligence Committee as part of its Russia probe?
Unusual timing, and especially for someone who is very steeped in the world of public relations. It does not look good. Her resignation announcement came one day after spending more than 8 hours answering questions from Republicans and Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee. Certain elements of that testimony were leaked out, including one comment in which she said, according to some of those lawmakers, that she sometimes tells what she called white lies on behalf of the president. That was a headline out of that particular testimony, and it didn't make Hope look good. And there was some reporting, not verified by Fox, that the president was upset with this particular headline coming out of her testimony.
That being said, though, the White House has sort of explained this, saying, no, Hope Hicks had been thinking about this decision for an awfully long time, that it was not entirely unexpected within the West Wing.
Well, they say that. I have my doubts about that, in the sense that you would not necessarily announce that you're leaving the day after you testify before a congressional investigative committee. You would do so perhaps weeks earlier, or weeks after such testimony took place, but not the day after. That's what made it look so surprising and caught so many people off guard, including members of her own staff. We're told that there were members of her staff when Hope Hicks broke the news to them that were literally crying in her office, upset that she was leaving her role at the White House.
Shifting a bit, what's up between the Attorney General and the President?
A little bit of a feud that is out in the public. President Trump tweeting once again some unflattering things about his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who, by the way, was the first U.S. Senator to endorse Donald Trump when he ran for president. So talk about loyalty. I don't think you can get any more loyal than that. And yet this president continues to criticize him. And it all goes back to Jeff Sessions' decision to recuse himself from the Russia investigation, which led to the appointment of that special counsel. The president is still angry about that. And that's the reason why he continues to level criticism publicly through the use of Twitter most often at his attorney general.
Part of that investigation is an internal investigation on the way FISA courts and these warrants were handled. The inspector general of the Justice Department is looking into that because presumably the Justice Department can't investigate itself, right?
That's exactly right. And so it's typical for the IG to do this type of investigation. The IG in this particular case, first named to that position by George W. Bush, held on through the Obama administration. So he's worked for both Republicans and Democrats. And yet the president was critical over the attorney general's decision to put it in the hands of the IG rather than put it in the hands of DOJ lawyers. But you ask various legal analysts, including our own Judge Napolitano, the attorney general did the right thing in putting this in the hands of the inspector general.
Let's talk about Jared Kushner, a senior advisor to President Trump, also the president's son-in-law. We have talked previously on this podcast about these new restrictions on access to classified information, how long these temporary clearances would work. And the chief of staff, John Kelly, sounds like clamped down.
He has clamped down. And it was last Friday during a joint press conference that the president said he would leave it to his chief of staff, General John Kelly, to determine whether or not the security clearance of Jared Kushner, the president's senior advisor and his son-in-law, would be downgraded. And in fact, a short time after the president made those statements, that's exactly what General Kelly did, downgraded the security clearance of Jared Kushner from top secret to secret, which means that he cannot see everything that the president sees, including the presidential daily brief, which essentially lists out all the trouble spots around the world and provides a lot of intelligence information that usually only very high-level administration officials such as the president and the vice president, other top aides, can see.
President Trump has more faith in his son-in-law than maybe other fathers have of their sons-in-law. And it is a massive portfolio that is in front of Kushner, including Middle East peace. How does this downgraded access impact his day-to-day job in the West Wing?
Well, the White House says it does not impact his ability to do his job. But when you have your security clearance downgraded in the manner that Jared Kushner has had his security clearance downgraded, it does impact your job. You can't do your job to the best of your ability if you can't see and read everything or be in all those meetings in which top secret information is exchanged. So it does impact his ability to do the job of a senior advisor to the president, including in that portfolio, trying to be the point person for Middle East peace.
It's been a busy week at the White House. Have a great weekend.
You too, Jared. Thanks
all
a
right.
lot.
Trade wars are good and easy to win. That declaration via a tweet from President Trump has shaken markets in the U.S. and overseas. It's created some odd political bedfellows as well. It all had to do with this unexpected announcement this week from the president.
We'll be imposing tariffs on steel imports and tariffs on aluminum imports and you're going to see a lot of good things happen. You're going to see expansions of the companies.
A potential 25% tariff on imported steel, a 10% tariff on imported aluminum, two metals used in the production of a lot of things you probably buy, like cars or beer. The Beer Institute, which sounds like a place I would have succeeded in at college, is actually a trade organization based here in D.C. It warns the tariff on aluminum would impose millions of dollars on the beverage industry and cost thousands of jobs.
The beer industry isn't trivializing it. The soft drink industry isn't trivializing it. Aerospace, automakers, and the hundreds of other industries that are downstream users of aluminum are not trivializing it.
Marcy Kaptur, an Ohio Democrat in the House, says the proposed action is needed to respond to a rigged global steel market. She says steelmaking communities are being whipsawed by unfair global trade and illegal dumping of steel.
We have Republic Steel, U.S. Steel, ArcelorMittal, Alcoa. We have America's defense and industrial base. We have Fiat Chrysler, Ford, General Motors. I mean, the list goes on. And we understand the delicate nature of tariffs, but we know America hasn't had a trade balance in over a quarter century.
Republican lawmakers are not all excited. Neither are a lot of U.S. allies and trade partners. So let's start with the basics with Fox Business Network's Adam Shapiro.
I guess a good place to start with this, Adam, is this tweet from the president that trade wars are good and easy to win. Are trade wars good and are they easy to win?
I'm not going to weigh in whether trade wars are good or not, but I think history says that trade wars don't always turn out the way people expect, and the outcome is usually pretty bad. And if you look back to the late 1920s and early 30s, it was the Smoot-Hawley tariff that helped take us into the Great Depression.
So who benefits from this tariff? Obviously, the steel executives that met with the president seem pretty happy to hear this news.
It depends on what their short-term or long-term goals are. But yeah, I mean, the steel industry has been battered for several decades. I used to live in Cleveland, Ohio, and I can remember between 1998 and 2004 how one of the major producers there, LTV, was driven into bankruptcy because of these very issues. Overproduction in other countries driving down the price of steel, and those countries, their government subsidizing steel. And I had friends who lost their jobs at LTV in Cleveland. So this is not some fantasy. This actually happens. The question is, do you protect the people I know, for instance, in Cleveland with a tariff? Because there was a study in 2003. We had tariffs on steel in 2002. And you can find this study. You can Google it. It's right there. In 2003, examining the result of the Bush steel tariffs. And the end result was that it cost 200,000 manufacturing jobs in the United States. I want to repeat that. There were 200,000 people who lost their jobs because of a tariff designed to protect the steel industry.
How does a trade war escalate?
Well, I'll give you an example, and this is a hypothetical. Let's say we did pass a tariff designed to hit China. So we passed the tariff so that the good that we now have slapped the tariff on costs more to import into the United States. Well, the Chinese say, okay, you want to play that game? We buy a lot of soybeans from Midwest farmers in the United States. So we are now going to impose a great high tariff to match the tariff the United States has imposed on the import of soybeans into China, because China can get its soybeans from South America. They can go to Argentina. So who winds up getting hurt? You've just protected an industry in the United States, but now you're hurting an industry, the agriculture industry, soybean farmers. So then the United States says, okay, you want to play that game? We're going to slap another tariff on another product that we import from China, to which the Chinese say, all right, we're going to cancel the order we just placed for a few dozen Boeing aircraft. That's how a trade war escalates.
And to be clear, when we talk about a tariff, we're talking about, at the most simplest terms, a tax at the point of entry.
That's correct. If it cost $1 to import the widget with a 30% tariff, it's now $1.30.
And so the company who we are buying that from, the country that is importing that, is unlikely to take that hit. They're going to pass that along to whoever
you
is buying it.
You and me.
Let me sort of present this at the devil's advocate point of view, and that is, if the steel and aluminum from other countries is going to cost more,
Isn't that an incentive to produce more in this country, buy American-made aluminum, buy American-made steel? Can't we do that as a country?
We can ramp up production in the United States. We're not at capacity in some of these industries. So, yeah, we could ramp up production, but it won't happen overnight. And it's not necessarily going to be cheaper to buy the American-made product, because remember, labor costs in the United States are much higher than in other parts of the world. One of the reasons that you see steel prices cheaper in other places is you have foreign governments which subsidize their industries. That's one reason. But the other reason is that labor's cheaper outside the United States.
The president's also talked a lot about infrastructure, rebuilding roads, bridges, buildings.
Yes.
Is that going to make that project more expensive?
Yes. Yeah. Listen, if you are Middle Steel in Cleveland, Ohio, which bought the remnants of LTV from another company, ISG, or if you're U.S. Steel, you know, there's going to be demand for steel. And if the price of steel is going up for imported steel and Americans have to get the steel, they're going to try to produce it. That's at least the logic behind it. Whether it truly happens, I can't tell you 100%. But they're going to try to meet the demand.
A lot of uncertainty. Adam, thanks for making sense of this. This is not the easiest stuff to understand sometimes.
My pleasure. You have a good day.
The tariff proposal has unsettled trade partners, including some of our closest geographically. Canada's foreign minister says trade restrictions on aluminum and steel are unacceptable and warned of a response to defend the Canadian workers. The UK's government is expressing concern as well. Let's head across the pond. Gauging global reaction is our London-based European correspondent, Simon Owen. Why is this causing such concern in your part of the world?
Well, at the moment, the Europeans, certainly in Western Europe, are speaking with one voice, and there's a lot of use of the word concerned and the word response also. And that's where the sort of concerns that we've seen on stock markets comes from, is that this could escalate into a tit-for-tat set of retaliatory measures. And if the United States does this, then the European Union might target something else. The Chinese might go after something else. And then that's how you get a trade war starting. And there you have the situation where President Trump says trade wars can be good and can be easy to win. But certainly elsewhere, among America's main trading partners, and that is both friends and rivals, that's not the kind of language you're used to them saying. And indeed, what we've heard from officials who've spoken along those lines now is that they're saying trade wars are in nobody's interest.
The United States and the UK are actually engaged right now in negotiations for a trade deal, aren't they?
Well, I mean, I suspect they're not quite on the way with it yet, but it's something that the UK is very keen on, and to be honest, the UK kind of needs. And if President Trump wants to back up his support for Brexit, and Britain's departure from the European Union is why Britain is so keen on striking a trade deal with the United States at the moment, if President Trump, who's always been a vocal Brexit supporter, if he wants to keep up that support, then a good way would be to strike a free trade deal with the United Kingdom. There are all sorts of things up in the air in British politics, and trade is one of the big things, because when you're a member of the European Union, you aren't able to strike your own trade deals. It's all done by Brussels. And one of the arguments put forward by those in favour of Brexit was that they said it was time that Britain struck out on its own and started making its own trade deals. Well, a really close ally like the United States and a massive market like the United States would be very appealing to many in Britain. So yes, we think there's going to be a trade deal in the pipeline, but these things take a long time to set up. And you know, there's no guarantee it's the sort of one size fits all perfect solution for the Brits, because President Trump, as we know, drives a hard bargain. He's an experienced businessman, and they'd be entering into a negotiation with his administration.
So the question is, would this proposal, this tariff proposal, complicate the prospects of a trade deal between the US and the UK?
I wouldn't have thought so, because I think in Europe, you're mainly looking at the Germans' reaction, because they are the leading European Union exporter of, I think, steel, if not aluminum as well. It's the German response that people were watching for. And Germany has come out and said that, you know, this line again, a trade war would be in nobody's interest. And Chancellor Merkel's spokesperson said that President Trump risks starting a trade war with the United States' closest allies. I think this is one of the confusions here, is these tariffs were announced, but there isn't much detail to go with it. And so I think the White House press secretary was asked, you know, will there be exceptions for allies, for close friendly trading partners? And it's not clear at the moment whether there will be. So there's not much kind of flesh on the bones. And until that stage, you're going to get countries that are a little bit concerned about this. I mean, the Canadians, who are the biggest supplier of steel and aluminum to the United States, Canada's government expressed perhaps the most robust response we saw, which was saying that it would take responsive measures to defend its workers. And that's the key with the trade dispute. It's all very well talking about a response, but the slightly different phrase is retaliation. And the Canadians seem to be hinting at retaliation already. Other countries are not going down that road just yet.
Simon, thanks so much. It's always good to get the perspective of how these policies are being felt and viewed overseas. I appreciate your perspective, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks a lot.
A stubborn monkey is on America's back. Opioid overdoses killing tens of thousands each year. This week, the Trump administration announced new steps for combating the crisis. Attorney General Jeff Sessions unveiled a task force to go after makers of prescription painkillers that he says have fueled the epidemic.
The pill task force will focus in particular on targeting opioid manufacturers and distributors who have contributed to this epidemic. We will use criminal penalties. We will use civil penalties.
Sessions said the Justice Department is backing plaintiffs in litigation accusing big-name drug makers of deceptive marketing practices. Among the companies named, Purdue Pharma, Teva Pharmaceutical, Endo International PLC, and Allegrin PLC, as well as the three biggest drug distributors in the U.S., AmerisourceBergen Corp., Cardinal Health, and McKesson, according to Reuters. This is a crisis stretches helpers to their breaking point. The New York Times featured a story last fall about a chief medical examiner in Concord, New Hampshire, Dr. Thomas Andrew, who retired amid an overflow of bodies in his morgue. In Dayton, Ohio, the fire department has been making a record-breaking number of runs for overdoses. Last summer, the department even started putting an engine on standby at certain times just to be available for overdose calls, according to the Dayton Daily News. Sam Quinones is a journalist and the author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. His research took him from the barrios of Mexico to now-shuttered pill mills in hard-hit rural Ohio.
I do believe there is a role for the Justice Department in going after bad actor doctors and distributors. I would say, however, that a far more perhaps long-term and maybe a more effective a way of addressing this is to really talk about the culture that creates the attitude among doctors who are well-meaning and sincere and well-trained and interested in the interests of their patients, changing their attitudes towards how they prescribe these pills. Because really, if you cut away all the bad actors, all the pill mills, it still would not account for more than a moderate fraction of the pills that were prescribed. Most of the pills that were prescribed were prescribed by doctors who thought they were doing the right thing by their patient, who were not, you know, kind of outliers, kind of scandalous quacks out in some strip mall somewhere, but were actually doctors who thought they were doing the right thing.
As you know, Sam, the White House held an opioid summit this week, and the president gave a rather eyebrow-raising suggestion, the death penalty for opioid dealers.
We have pushers and we have drug dealers that don't, I mean, they kill hundreds and hundreds of people, and most of them don't even go to jail. You know, if you shoot one person, they give you life, they give you the death penalty. These people can kill 2,000, 3,000 people, and nothing happens to them. And we need strength with respect to the pushers and to the drug dealers. And if we don't do that, you're never going to solve the problem. If you want to be weak and you want to talk about just blue ribbon committees, that's not the answer. The answer is you have to have strength and you have to have toughness. The drug dealers, the drug pushers they're really doing damage. They're really doing damage. Some countries have a very, very tough penalty, the ultimate penalty. And by the way, they have much less of a drug problem than we do.
What do you make of that idea?
My feeling was, does he mean people who are, you know, drug reps? Does he mean pharmaceutical executives? Does he mean doctors? I'm sure he doesn't. I'm sure he's referring to people in the black market. But I think in order to really get a handle on that, he needs to understand that this is a unique situation in the history of America, certainly modern America, and that the problem resides really in deeper issues than simply what's going on in the black market.
What do you think is really the solution then to people who are already hooked?
So I think we got into this problem as a culture because we wanted one solution to a very, very complicated problem. The complicated problem was the mystery of human pain. The easy one-size-fits-all silver bullet solution was pain pills for everybody, every kind of human being, every background, every kind of pain. We're just going to give you all pain pills.
Psychologist and addiction expert Stanton Peel, who promotes harm reduction, says he doesn't believe overprescription is the problem.
I want to refer people, if I may, to the cover story in Reason Magazine, which is just out, which I didn't write. It's by Jacob Sullivan. And it claims that we're actually killing addicts with our current policies. Here's how that works. West Virginia has over 50 deaths per 100,000 per annum, but West Virginia doesn't have a large number of opioid prescriptions. By the way, opioid prescriptions have been going down steadily since 2010. In 2015, 98 million Americans took a pain medication, and from 1 to 2% of them encountered any kind of a problem, let alone anything as severe as addiction or overdose.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions this week announced a policy targeting manufacturers of pharmaceutical companies that produce these drugs. And what's your take on that?
Well, we're going in the wrong direction. It's not a source supply, which gets us back to let's kill all the drug dealers. It's not a source supply problem. Drugs are here to stay. You can get them on the internet. If you don't get them from your doctor, which is the preferred way to get them, you can get them on the street. We're focusing on the wrong problem, in part because dealing with poverty in West Virginia or the chaos of inner city Baltimore, which is the heroin capital of the world, is something that's beyond our scope. We're afraid of it, and so we simplify everything by imagining if we cut off drug supplies, we'll cut off drug problems.
Meanwhile, as policymakers brainstorm solutions, emergency crews and morgues are working overtime across the country on hopes the tide will turn toward the unhooking of America.
Monday is March 5th. It's a date that has been viewed as a deadline to fix DACA. But the president's plan to end the deferred deportation action for childhood arrivals is tangled in court. Federal judges say the program must continue. The Supreme Court turned away a fast-track request to hear arguments, instead giving the federal appeals system time to sort it all out. So we don't expect Congress to move on immigration next week, or guns for that matter, at least not right away. We could see if lawmakers can build consensus, though, what has the votes, what doesn't. President Trump also has some decisions to make on trade, on defense, and potentially staffing. Of course, a lot can happen between now and our next podcast, so the best way to stay up to date is our top-of-the-hour newscast, either right on your radio or the Fox News Radio app. You can also hear Fox News on Amazon's Alexa, Apple Siri, and Google Play. Just ask for Fox News. You can also ask for your favorite Fox News Radio podcast, like this one from Washington, or the Fox News Rundown. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.